At the Table with Tony is brought to you by Trafe Hustlin'. That's www.traifhustlin.com. Your home for all things barbecue. Welcome to At the Table with Tony. My name is Anthony Sciglia, better known as Tony Mangia. And today on our live stream show, we're doing something a little bit different. We are going to dedicate this whole show to one of the most important saints in our day and age, the one and only San Rocco, St. Rocco. So today I'm being joined by devotees of San Rocco. So we're going to get their story. We're going to dive into it. Right now we have Stephanie Longo and we have Stephen LaRocca. We are supposed to also be joined by Rosella Rago. So hopefully she'll be on shortly. So until that time, Stephanie, welcome to the show. And I want you to, if you don't mind kind of introducing who you are. I know you're part of the, you're an award-winning author. You're the producer of the Italian-American podcast. So give us a little bit of your background and then we'll get into Stephen's background. Then we'll get into San Rocco.
Sure. So first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you again. And it's great to meet Stephen. And Rosella is one of the co-hosts of the podcast. So it will be really nice to have her on as well. As you said, I'm the associate producer of the Italian-American podcast, which I always say to everybody is the best day job in the world because I get to do what I love full time. So I just love it. I'm also an author of Italian-American regional history here in northeastern Pennsylvania. And in terms of St. Rocco for tonight, so my family actually comes from the town of Guardia Lombardi in the province of Avellino in Irpinia. And I have a blog called Irpinia Stories that I just use to tell people about the area in English. A lot of Americans don't really know much about Irpinia, so I try to educate them via my blog. And St. Rocco is one of our town's saints. There's actually three saints that Guardia is devoted to. And St. Rocco is one of those saints. So I'm very happy to be here tonight.
Excellent. And Stephen, give us a little bit of your background and your devotion to San Rocco.
Well, I am the president of the San Rocco Society of Potenza in New York City. I've been so for, over 20 years. And this year, God willing, if it doesn't happen in August, maybe it'll happen a little later on, we'd be celebrating our 131st annual Feast of San Rocco. And the tremendous part of my life is dedicated to San Rocco and to the preparation of his feast and the spreading of the word about who he is for us as Italian Americans and who he is to the world.
Excellent. Yeah. And you know, I mean, St. Rocco really is important to Southern Italians in particular. Obviously, I know many cultures and many, you know, the French are, because actually, I guess we should talk a little bit about who St. Rocco is, maybe a little bit of background on the saint. So he wasn't actually born in Italy, correct?
Shockingly, yes, that's true.
He was born in a little town of, I know I'm going to say it wrong because I don't speak French, but Montpellier.
I believe that's perfect pronunciation. Good.
Did I say it right? he's actually a Frenchman, but correct. but he did go on many pilgrimages. So correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I know a lot. Most of what I know about San Rocco, I read on Wikipedia, and I've learned from you, Stephen. So I hope that I'm saying the right thing. So correct me if I'm wrong.
So far, perfect.
So far, so good. He was a Third Order Franciscan, correct?
Correct. I'm not interrupting you until I hear a mistake. So you go.
And I know that he traveled extensively, particularly in Italy and in the south of Italy.
He actually, none of his miracles or travels took place in the south of Italy. They were all in the north.
Really?
Yeah. And his cult, which, you know, Americans get nervous when they hear the word cult, but it's actually a Catholic term in regard to his veneration in southern Italy, began with, shockingly, epidemics. Cholera, but first, probably the Black Plague itself, the bubonic plague that he lived through and that his miracles are so tightly associated with during his life. But his cult was introduced into southern Italy during outbreaks of both the bubonic plague as well as cholera. And he just took off. We were discussing before we became live with Stephanie how, you know, a large number of towns in Avellino either have him as patron or there's a great devotion. In Basilicata, he as patron saint is almost about 80% of the towns in Basilicata. And if he's not the patron saint, he's co. And if he's not the co, you believe me, there's a devotion to him in the town. But that could be said of, you know, there are very few areas in southern Italy where he's not a superstar, but he's known. Mm-hmm. And as I said in one of our last wonderful opportunities that you gave me to speak. I think at the turn of the century, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, Italian immigrants were all Southerners, of course, and we're all living in extreme, with the exception of the rural areas, like certain parts of Pennsylvania and others, we were mostly crammed in tenements in big cities. And so disease spread even more rapidly there, perhaps, than it did in Italy, because there wasn't the campagna, you know, the countryside to escape to. Here it was all urban America. And I think in my personal opinion, and I believe I've read it before, but my own opinion is that that further cemented and increased the devotion to St. Rocco in the United States among Southern Italian immigrants, bringing in people who might not have had this tremendous devotion to him in their particular town. It might have been another saint that they prayed to for sickness. But he really, I know in the case of our feast, that's why we're 100, one of the reasons why we're 131-year-old societies, because we drew in people from every Southern Italian background, not only Potenza, Basilicata, but any people that lived in the neighborhood who might not have had that devotion in their own towns back in Italy.
So I mean, really, but again, so we're living through this coronavirus pandemic. It's really, you know, it's really taking its toll, especially here in the Northeast and in New York and in New Jersey. And so really, we talked a little bit about this on a previous show that was dedicated to the saints in general. But really, like you said, now more than ever, it's important to kind of, you know, kind of go under the wing or go under the mantle of San Rocco, kind of, you know, pray to him, turn to him for his intercession. Because like you said, it was most likely during the bubonic plague where he had that, what, the boil or the actual plague on his...
an ulceration on his leg.
It manifests on their lower extremities, correct?
Correct.
And that's... So can you kind of... Maybe, I know, Stephen, like I said, you know more about the actual, I guess, the miracle about the... Because he's also usually... I forgot my statue. It's downstairs in my little shrine to San Rocco. So he's usually depicted with bread, with a little dog, with a piece of bread in his mouth. So can you kind of explain a little bit about what that meaning is behind that?
Sure. Essentially what happened was San Rocco went on pilgrimage to Rome. After having gone to Compostela in Spain, where he received the scallop shell that you'll see attached to his chest. That was a sign of having made the pilgrimage to St. James in Compostela. But after that, he went to northern Italy, where plague was ravaging every city he went in. And he literally just jumped in and nursed the people. He would make the sign of the cross over people, and they would be healed. He ultimately got the plague himself. So rather than, because of its tremendous contagious aspect, he dragged himself into a wooded area where he found like a cave. And he went into the cave and he said, this way I'll die, but I won't infect anyone. Mm-hmm. A dog saw him go into the cave, and this dog would steal bread from his master's table on a daily basis and bring it to St. Rocco. After a few weeks, the master started paying attention. Where does this dog go after breakfast every day? Why is he always, never did this before? He steals bread and I don't know where he is. So he followed the dog and he found St. Rocco in the cave, brought him back to his home, nursed him back to health, and that's when San Rocco returned to his own country, but he had been so ravaged from being so ill that no one recognized him. They thought he was a spy, and naturally the cities were always at war with each other. And he was thrown into prison, where he remained for 5 years until he died.
Holy cow, that's unbelievable. That really is an amazing story. So, Stephanie, what is the... So we were talking a little bit about the connection to San Rocco, to your town in Italy. So can you tell us what is the connection? So is he the patron saint of Guardia Lombardia? Hold on a second. Is it Guardia Lombardia?
Lombardi. Okay. Guardia Lombardi, yes.
Okay, so what is San Rocco's connection to your town?
So St. Rocco is one of our co-patrons / protector of Guardia. It depends on who you're actually speaking to. And I alluded to this before we became live. But there was a little bit of a to-do in the 1950s with St. Rocco in Guardia, but the veneration to him in Guardia actually goes back to 1656, when the bubonic plague and a drought were actually sweeping through Guardia. It killed 1,100 of 1,475 residents. So really a lot, and thankfully some of my ancestors survived that plague, or else I would not be here talking to you. And the first processions in honor of St. Rocco actually took place in 1656. The year before, the town's priest, Don Nunzio De Leo, actually left 20 ducats, which are about $3,000 today, in his will to build a chapel to St. Rocco. And unfortunately, Don Nunzio actually died of the plague that year. So he died in 1656 because of this plague. But the townspeople in Guardia built a chapel in his honor at the entrance to town. It was near the area of town. If you go up the hill to get into Guardia, there's actually, if you take a right, you end up at the Bevedi Fountain, which was the closest fountain to town. So the closest place where you could get water. So that's where they tried to keep it, because obviously water was something that you needed if, God forbid, a plague hit town. So this chapel in honor of St. Rocco stood from August 1st, 1656, up until 1957, when it was torn down for a housing project. Allegedly, the chapel had fallen into disrepair, except that many townspeople said that wasn't true. The tradition in the town was for everybody to come that lived in the neighborhood near the chapel and actually clean it about the month before St. Rocco's feast day. And, you know, people said that it was falling into disrepair. They ended up tearing it down. Some of the pieces ended up being used to build a road in Guardia. Other pieces were just kind of thrown at random in the town. But fortunately, someone was able to save the old altar as well as another piece of the building. So that's actually in the town's museum, and you could go and see that today. But the town historian in Guardia, Salvatore Boniello, a good friend of mine, he passed away a few years ago, and with him went a lot of Guardia's history. Thank goodness he wrote it down. Thank goodness the townspeople are very concerned about preserving their history. But he told me that ever since St. Rocco was chased away from Guardia, that's when Guardia started seeing its decline, because in the 1950s, it actually saw its highest population, believe it or not. It had about 5,000 people. And today it's under 2,000 people living in Guardia. And they say because St. Rocco was essentially kicked out of town, the town's luck went with him.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. That really is, I mean, it really is it's an amazing story. I mean, really, I mean, you know, you sometimes don't think that how really connected these saints are, these devotions are. And then when such things start like this happen, you're like, oh, it's kind of scratch your head. You say, okay, maybe there's something to this.
It's pretty crazy because up until this business with the chapel, and that was how St. Rocco ended up getting elevated to a patron saint of the town. Up until that point, Guardia's patron saints were Pope St. Leo IX and San Gaetano, and they were Guardia's patron saints. St. Rocco was considered the protector of Guardia up until this point. In the United States, at least here in Dunmore at the Church of St. Rocco, he was given the title of the protector of the Guardiers because the immigrants from Guardia to Dunmore prayed to him to protect them. So when they tore down this chapel, they decided they were going to build a statue, and the townspeople hate the statue as well. There's actually sayings in one of the history books that I showed you before where they were saying, well, he looks like a soldier coming back from war and not a saint that actually roamed the forests like St. Rocco did. Like, what's going on with this? But on that statue that you see in Piazza San Rocco in Guardia Lombardi, it says patron of Guardia, but if you speak to the Guardiers, they will say he is not the patron of the town. He is the protector of the town. The patrons are these other saints. So we venerate him as the patron of Guardia here in Dunmore because of his role. But yeah, the Guardiers in Guardia will tell you he has a little bit of a different role.
So what does this statue look like? He's dressed as a soldier?
I have it right here because I have the Guardia actually published a book about their devotion to St. Rocco. So I'll try to stick that.
Oh, nice.
There it is.
So it's not actually in a church. It's just outside of, like, it's like in a piazza?
Yep, it's in the piazza. Huh. Santa Maria delle Grazie is actually the main church in Guardia Lombardi. And during the procession in honor of St. Rocco that they have every August, we actually have one similar to it in August as well. It always happens the week after in Dunmore. But in Guardia, they also have this mantle in honor of St. Rocco.
Oh,
and
beautiful.
That has been getting people's gold jewelry or silver jewelry or whatever they want to donate in silver and gold since the 1600s. And it got to the point in the 1990s where that was pretty much falling apart due to the weight, because there was more stuff on there than velvet to actually handle it. They did a complete restoration of it. And unfortunately, it's so heavy now that they can't bring it out in procession. It's actually one of the towns in Irpinia that does not have the mantle in the procession. So allegedly, it was part of the bank of Avellino was storing it. And then the Diocese of Sant'Angelo dei Lombardi was storing it. And now they're bringing it out at least every year around St. Rocco's feast day for people to look at. But they can't have it actually go through the town as part of the procession because there's so much stuff on there. They said it would be a matter of extreme security and it would cost more for the security to protect that than
that is unbelievable. But so again, there is so in Dunmore, that's outside of Scranton, correct?
Yes, it is a suburb of Scranton, and I will be the most proud person in the world to tell you that we are the number 12 most populous Italian town in the nation, and wow, number one in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which makes me very happy because I'm a Dunmore native. So,
that was the town that a lot of the Guardiese settled in when they came over.
Yes.
Where else did they go? Do you know?
A lot of Guardiese went to New York City. The New York City metropolitan area in New Jersey. In fact, if you go into Santa Maria delle Grazie in Guardia Lombardi, because of the 1980 Irpinia earthquake, there was actually a collection that was taken up amongst the Guardiese community in the United States. So you'll see Mount Vernon, New Rochelle, Scranton, Dunmore on this beautiful plaque that they put in the back of the church celebrating that. But actually Dunmore's Guardiese community splits. So the area is called Bunker Hill, and the way that Bunker Hill is set up, it splits between Scranton and Dunmore. The procession actually crisscrosses and zigzags between Scranton and Dunmore as it's going.
So that's the weekend. God willing, they'll have it this year, but it's the weekend after his feast day.
Yes. Is it right? So it's usually like around the feast day. They sometimes have it before, sometimes after, depending on the church calendar. It's gone through a lot of changes over the years, especially since the Diocese of Scranton's restructuring. The Church of St. Rocco was united with the Parish of St. Anthony here in Dunmore, which is very funny because it was founded by people from Calitri, Provincia di Avellino. So they actually united them into that. And they added a statue of St. Anthony to the procession. So that was the first time that it actually became a carbon copy of what's in Guardia.
Really?
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
That's pretty wild. Now, Stephen, you are the president of it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it the oldest St. Rocco society?
I want to say yes, but I don't want to offend in case I'm wrong, but I don't think we're one of the oldest Italian religious societies dedicated to a saint in the country. We're not the oldest, but we're up there, probably top 10 easily. But for St. Rocco, I dare say we're the oldest existing. There might have been those before us, but didn't make it as long as we've been able to.
Now, I know that St. Rocco obviously plays a very important role in your life, and there was a miracle with your grandmother, and I want to get into that. But first, I want you to talk a little bit about the actual society and the actual feast that is held in New York City. So I know that it kind of changed a lot over the years because originally it was what, St. Joachim's Church, and then when that church got was abolished or was demolished.
Demolished.
Right, yes. The feast moved to St. Joseph's, and then from St. Joseph's, now it's at Most Precious Blood. So can you give us a little bit of the history of your feast in New York City, please?
Sure, of course. In August of 1889, immigrants from the city of Potenza, so not necessarily the province, but actually the city, the capital of the province, Potenza, came to New York City and formed the first, it was actually called Confraternita de San Rocco de Potenza, so a confraternity as opposed to a society. They imported a statue which is an exact duplicate of the one in the city of Potenza, which is interesting too. Potenza itself, the patron saint is San Gerardo, but not the San Gerardo we all think of, not San Gerardo Maiella, but an older San Gerardo, a bishop. But his role was just to kind of take care of the town, and the real favorite in the town was St. Rocco, who they used to say was the Santo dei Contadini, the peasant saint. And so when all the immigrants from the city of Potenza went to New York and also to Chicago, because their society is about, I'm guesstimating, about 15, 20 years younger than ours, but they too chose to recreate St. Rocco in Chicago. But in any event, they began the Feast of St. Rocco August 16th, 1889, on what was then known as Roosevelt Street. And I've said at the last podcast, you know, a lot of Americans see Manhattan's Little Italy as being primarily Mulberry Street. But in as much as there were literally hundreds of thousands of Southern Italian immigrants in Lower Manhattan, they couldn't have all lived on Mulberry Street. So we all if you have any knowledge of Lower Manhattan, where this Roosevelt Street was would be smack dab in the middle of the FDR.
Wow.
It was behind Police Plaza, again, which didn't exist at that time, at the very bottom of Mulberry Street. So there was Mulberry Bend, which now has Columbus Park. If you go even further east, there was a sprawling area that encompassed Roosevelt, Oak Street, and a few other streets. And, you know, if you picture these tenements that were six stories high with three-room apartments with people with, on average, 10 to 15 children, they were packed in. And the Scalabrinis founded the St. Joachim. Again, in the Lower East Side, we call them St. Joachim. Everyone else seems to call them St. Joachim. But that was an Italian national parish, of which the Putanzes, who founded this society, were a big part of. All the saint societies had to pay rent to the church to have their statues in the church. This is before the years of a social club where the paisani would have their saint. The people could barely pay their rents. They certainly couldn't pay to have a social club. So, there's a register in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle of Italian, but they were all Southern Italian societies in Manhattan and Brooklyn. And there has to be 500 of them. And most of the addresses of these societies are just apartment houses. You know, they gave the president's address, but most of the time their statues were in a church. So San Rocco was there. He became the feast on Roosevelt Street. There's not a lot of information about how many other feasts there were. I'm sure there were many, because there were many patron saints of different towns in the church. But his feast became the just gigantic. At the same time in the Lower East Side, there were three or four other St. Rocco feasts going on literally blocks away, all on the same day, just from different towns. All of them Basilicata towns, one Ruoti, Provincia di Potenza, that had theirs at Transfiguration Church on Mott Street. Savoia da Lucania up, I want to say, west, by what is now Old St. Patrick's Cathedral, and there were a few more. So there were plenty of St. Rocco societies and plenty of feasts. Some of the elderly people I knew told me, well, if you made the vow to walk barefoot, you were better off going to the one on Mott Street, because they always had their procession early in the morning, and it wasn't so hot. It was better than ours, which always began around 2 in the afternoon. So it was huge. If you go to the public library's website, there have to be at least 100 beautiful vintage photos from the 20s and the 30s of the feast. And we thrived there for many years until 1958, when urban renewal began and the decision was to demolish Roosevelt Street, Oak Street. Initially, the promise was made that St. Joachim's would be spared. They would make some kind of a triangle around it. But, I mean, if you think about the FDR and everything that's there, that wasn't ever going to be possible. But in the 20s, there were just too many Italians for St. Joachim. So they had a mission church of St. Joseph, San Giuseppe. It's still standing there, although not an operating church. And it says on the top of at the very top of the church, San Giuseppe, to this day. It was built, as I said, as a mission. And no one ever thought it was going to take the place of St. Joachim, but it in fact did. But many, many, many people, including my own family, did not think that St. Rocco survived after the destruction of St. Joachim. So those who remained in the neighborhood knew it, and people that were related to them. But if anyone had left the neighborhood to move to Brooklyn or anywhere else and lost touch with people, just assumed, there's always a danger when you change a feast location that people assume it's over. Oh, gosh. Now, naturally, this is the problem from doing things from home. My kid locked himself out, and he's ringing the doorbell. So excuse me as I go down the stairs and continue to talk. I had a feeling that was going to happen, but I live on the second floor, and I didn't want to leave the door open. All right. Salvatore. Come in, Salvatore. Yeah.
Hello, peoples.
Okay. Hi, Salvatore.
Hey, Salvatore.
So shy. The lawyer's son. I guess he can't help it. In any event, we thrived at St. Joseph's until 5 years ago, when St. Joseph was closed by the Archdiocese of New York, and we were asked, thankfully, by Bishop O'Hara, whose job it was to close the churches. He called me and said, Stephen, you know, the Cardinal, which I was shocked the Cardinal even had a clue that this was going on, believes this is a true religious experience that you guys are doing. So we don't want to see you end. And I said, with all due respect, Bishop O'Hara, if St. Rocco has to come out of my basement, we won't end. But of course, we would love a home in the Lower East Side where it all began. He's invited us to go to Most Precious Blood, where we've been ever since. So that's kind of the history of our moves. At one time in the way into the 1940s, probably shortly after the Second World War, the procession undoubtedly had, it didn't rival Our Lady of Mount Carmel in East Harlem, but it had hundreds of thousands of people attending. I mean, it was a sight to behold. New York Magazine in the 30s did an expose because let's face it, at that time, Americans were not used to these spectacular Italian festivals, and it was meaningful to people who were not part of the community. So we had a great, great, great run. But of course, with the people moving out of the neighborhood, the destruction of the original church, we had a little bit of a twilight. But certainly, thankfully, let me watch this kid. I think he's going down the stairs again. Salvatore, is mommy across the street?
Yeah.
All right, wait a while. I'm surprised they didn't do this during my five-hour deposition today. I'm so sorry, Anthony. Please forgive me.
No, no worries. So, Stephanie, let's just talk. Let's talk while Stephen comes back. Let's just talk a little bit about. Now, I know that you are an award winning author, and I'm trying to put your website up here on the bottom of the screen. So, kind of tell us a little bit about your website as well.
Sure. Irpinia Stories is my little side project. I think that we all have side projects when we do our Italian-American things. We find that one thing that we just love so much about our heritage and our culture that we just love to do in our spare time. And for me, it's Irpinia Stories. I realize that a lot of people in the United States, if I would say, well, my family's from this town in Irpinia, they would have no clue what Irpinia even was.
Exactly.
So I decided to do this blog and just start telling stories about Irpinia in English for Italian Americans or really anybody who's interested in Irpinia or Campania. And I've gotten to tell some really cool stories. My most recent story up there is of a group of people who are part of the Scuola di Tarantella out there that did a recording of the Tarantella di Montemiletto, and they did it via WhatsApp. And they spliced everything together and did it. Getting to tell these stories is really important. And St. Rocco is such an integral part of our region of Italy that I'm so thankful to you for doing this show because, like I said before, 31 towns in Irpinia have a devotion to him. And they all have like this plague story. There's always something going on with the plague. One of my favorite stories is actually the story of Flumini, if you want me to tell that story.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So in Flumini, they have the famous giglio that they raise every August for St. Rocco. And it's made out of straw. And it dates back to pre-Christianity. It used to be in honor of the goddess Ceres, who was the goddess of agriculture. But during the 1600s, they ended up developing this devotion to St. Rocco. And the reason why is because, like Guardia, Flumini also got hit by the bubonic plague. Their population went from 600 down to 240 people. And the citizens started praying to St. Rocco to stop the plague. And they were also getting hit by earthquakes. Unfortunately, as I said before, Irpinia is on this terrible earthquake line. The 1980 earthquake, the 1930 earthquake in Irpinia, there's always been a lot of destruction in the area because of earthquakes. So during this time, it was the month of July, and a man named Rocco was going from Ariano Irpino to San Nicola Baronia. And as he was going, it was overnight, it was about 3 a.m, he met a man near the gates of Flumini, and he was looking out toward the town, and Rocco was like, what are you doing here? Why are you
good
standing?
Good Southern Italian reaction.
Of course, the suspicion right there. He was like, what are you doing here? Why are you looking at the town? And this man was unknown, never seen before, clearly didn't speak like somebody from the area, and he said, I'm watching over this town and those who live there.
Wow.
And the man was never seen or heard from again. So they believe that it was actually St. Rocco standing there at the gate of Flumini that night, watching over the town.
That is unbelievable.
I believe it was him.
I do too. I definitely believe it was him.
Now, Irpinia is a region or an area of Avellino. Like it's how does that geographically work? Because I know there's like Ariano, Irpino. that, so, you know, is that like a, I don't know, like a county, say, like we have over here? Could you explain that a little bit?
The best way that I explain it to people is I try not to get into the whole geographic boundaries, because if I say this town's not Irpinia, but this one is, so get in trouble. So I say
you're going to have an enemy fest.
Exactly.
Man.
So I usually say it roughly corresponds to the province of Avellino.
That's very fair. It's very diplomatic.
Yes. And that's exactly what they do. There have been thoughts in Avellino province to actually split the province, and there would be a new province of Alta Irpinia with Ariano Irpino as the capital. But that's been like the Quebecois separatist movement. They talk about it and then they stop talking about it. They talk about it again 10 years later and then never heard from again. So maybe they'll do it one day. Maybe they won't do it one day. Who knows? But that has been talked about
and
in the area.
And I doubt that it'll do it. I mean, all my family's papers, their citizenship and their birth certificate, all have the towns in the province of Potenza. It was not until the 1980s that my family and I realized those towns are all now in the province of Matera, which didn't exist at the time of the Great Immigration. Everything was Potenza. And then I think it's in the late 20s or 30s where they split it down and made Matera kind of to the east and Potenza to the west, although I don't know that that's exactly right. But they created two provinces. You know, I don't see the point. I think that it's nice that Basilegada, the other name for Basilegada is Lucania.
Lucania, yep.
And if you no one says I'm Basilegada, everyone says Sono Lucano or Lucana. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I always wondered why they had, because even like, for example, like Abruzzo and Molise, before, I guess it was the 1960s, there were, it was one.
Abruzzo, yeah.
Yeah, it was because a lot of people, when they came here, they said, oh, I'm Abruzzese. But no, they technically, In the new designation, they're actually either usually Campobasso or what's the other one? Esernia. Esernia is the other province in Molise. So it really is interesting. So the other, I know that they're in Paterson, New Jersey. There is another devotion to San Rocco, and they're from a town called Monte Scaglioso.
Monte Scaglioso, yeah.
And I was recently talking to some Monte Scagliosese, I guess you say it, and they actually said that they still have the clubhouse there, which I was very surprised, because the neighborhood has changed a bit over the years. But what I found out was that the statue is in the actual church, the St. Anthony's Church in Paterson. But speaking of statues, I'm going to actually put up a picture of the statue of San Rocco in New York City. And this statue has so much history, right, Stephen? So, I mean, just look. Oh, I think Rosella's here. We have Rosella.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Rosella.
Hey, Rose.
Rosella.
Hi.
I'm sorry. I screwed everything up for you. I apologize.
Okay. So I just have some bad news. My husband's like going to come home in like 15 minutes. So I only have 15 minutes because he's there.
All right. So
I also have bad news, Anthony. I'm on 19%. So if I plug in, I won't be able to use the earpieces.
Okay. So let's let Rosella. I wonder, because she has an amazing story about San Rocco. So for Rosella, again, thank you for joining us. I apologize for the confusion and the technology hiccups, but thank you for being on the show. So kind of tell us your story about San Rocco, which is amazing.
So we're from Molenti Body, and
now Rose frozen.
I'm frozen.
you're back.
I hate machines. Okay, so I'm sorry if I freeze. I have no control. I'm literally not touching anything, so it's not me. So we're from Molenti Body, and San Rocco is a patron saint of Molenti Body, one of the patron saints, because La Madonna Dolorata is like the patron saint. But San Rocco is also one of them, and we celebrate his feast day in August. And basically, my great-grandmother, Regina, so I'm Rosella Regina, so I have her middle name. And she had a tumor that I believe it was a uterine tumor. So something like super incurable in the 1950s. It's incurable now. Imagine back then. It was basically just a death sentence. And one night, she said that she dreamt of the San Rocco procession. And they lived on Corso Umberto, which was the main street in Mola di Bari, and all the processions passed through there. So she said that San Rocco came into her room from the procession and became, like, from the big statue, became a small statue and sat on her dresser. And she just saw it sit there. And then he passed through the other balcony door and left, and he was big San Rocco again on the procession. So when she woke up the next morning, she found a mass under her bed, and it looked like a tumor. It was weird. So they put it in a jar and they brought it to Bari, to the doctor. And he just, like, looked at the jar, and he was like, "Ma signora, siete devote a qualche santo."
So wait, so the mass was in a jar. You put the mass in the jar.
They put it in a jar.
Holy cow!
And they took it to Bari, and the guy's like looking at it, and he's like, "Oh, are you devoted to some kind of saint here? Because this is a miracle." Like, that was a medical diagnosis, like diagnosis miracle.
Wow, that's crazy.
That is unbelievable.
They give my aunts give money to San Rocco every year now, because, you know,
they don't forget. That's gratitude. You don't forget.
So that was your great grandmother.
Yes. So okay. Her daughters, my grandmother is her daughter, and her other daughters are my great aunts that are still living. And they make sure they make, like, a donation to San Rocco every year.
So do they have a big procession? Obviously, do they still have this procession in Mola?
Oh, yeah, they have a procession. They have a small feast. It's not as big as the Madonna feast, but it's very nice. I mean, I like it better because it's smaller. It's more intimate. It's less craziness in the town. But the street that my husband's grandmother lived in. So when we go to stay in Mola di Bari now, we stay at his grandmother's home. And she was very devoted to San Rocco. So in that street, like, there's, like, stations throughout Mola di Bari where San Rocco is meant to stop. And wherever he is meant to stop, you build an altar. So in that street, they still build a really beautiful altar to him. I posted a picture of it a few weeks ago, because it's very pretty with all the eyelet lace draping and flowers. And, you know, you can stop there.
Bless
you.
And take a prayer card. So it is, like, a very meaningful tradition.
Now, Rosella, I know we kind of jump right into the story, but if you can, just give us a little bit of your background. Kind of tell us a little bit about who you are.
I host the show Cooking with Nona, and I run the website cookingwithnona.com. And I'm a food blogger, and I cook with different Italian grandmothers from different parts of Italy.
That's awesome.
I am one fifth of the Italian American podcast.
Well, everything you do is amazing. You're an amazing person. I've known you for gee whiz for a long time.
I
remember you were on my radio show. Holy cow! Like 12 years ago, probably.
I'm good at everything except accessing streaming platforms.
Well, you did a great job. I apologize. I don't use Zoom anymore. I've been using this new. And now I'm plugging this new company, StreamYard. It makes streaming so much easier. You could put overlays. You could put names on the bottom. It's a lot different, but it's a little bit more complicated. So I do apologize for everybody for having a little bit of technical difficulties this evening. But again, I do want to thank you all for coming on. And Rosella, whenever you have to leave, you know, I don't want to keep you. So I wanted you to share that story because Patrick told me about it. I couldn't believe it. And it is amazing. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I don't believe all. I mean, I wonder how much has been embellished over the years, but, you know, my family, we're a little cheap, so I don't think we would keep giving money to San Rocco if he didn't invest in an actual miracle. So that's if my
sounds like
it happens, it happens.
It sounds like all the miracles I've heard of San Rocco are all fantastic and hard to believe, but when you've lived them, you know that they are 100% correct.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain things that I think you just can't explain in different ways in other ways that, you know, we always I think the American side of us wants to go after the tangible, but the Italian side of us is very much comfortable with this idea of the intangible.
Absolutely.
mysticism is still very much alive in that culture, more than, you know, the jaded American side of us where it's like, don't be ridiculous, that could never happen. You know, here you have a medical doctor in the 1950s, you know, proclaiming this is a miracle. So it wasn't just folklore. It wasn't just
and it wasn't 500 years ago. I mean, the 1950s are not that long ago.
Right.
And you have plenty of people alive to tell you they saw it. So
I just think it's so interesting how, you know, as different the two cultures are, that side of things is just so much more comfortable with this kinds of concepts where
absolutely,
like, don't be ridiculous. Like, that did not happen. Like,
no, but you're right. Because sometimes us as Americans, you know, we kind of say, I mean, it's, you know, if it's not proved by science, it can't be true, but that's not always the case. And I think our faith and our devotions show that firsthand. I mean, I think everybody here can say that, you know, whether it's San Rocco, whether it's St. Anne, I know in my family, St. Anne is very important because she helped many people in my family achieve pregnancy where, you know, so, I mean, so really there are these saints that otherwise, you know, you say to yourself, I mean, this is great. I mean, I guess the outsider would say, this is crazy. You know, somebody in Norway or the Norwegians would say, you Italians are nuts, but really, this is the truth. This is the truth.
This is the truth. This is our life. Yeah.
Well, Tony, even though he's actually calling me. So one more second. But even though Italy is kind of detached from Catholicism largely, you know, they still have space. They still hold space for this kind of mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
They don't get married in a church anymore, but they probably hear the miracle story and be like, yeah, that probably happened.
Yeah.
But well, I even have to say, there's a story here in northeastern Pennsylvania that's a great one.
Bye, Rosella.
Bye, nice to see you.
Bye.
Ciao.
Bye. There's a story here in northeastern Pennsylvania about St. Anne that she's actually considered the patron saint of the city of Scranton because she saved it.
Oh, yes. There's a gorgeous basilica there.
Yes, the Basilica of St. Anne on Westside. So it almost, that entire section of the city of Scranton almost fell into a mine due to just the mining, coal mining. There's no more stability underneath the earth there. And there was nothing that the engineers or anybody can do. And people started praying to St. Anne to ask her for her intercession because they just didn't know. And she's also a patron of impossible cases along with St. Jude. And all of a sudden, there's this mine subsidence and this giant boulder rolls right underneath the hill and everything is saved. I lived on that hill and every so often you would feel a little bit of a shake, but you knew that you weren't going to crash down. It was pretty amazing. But, you know, nobody could explain this. The engineer said, oh, man, we got to get everybody off of this hill. There's going to be a lot of problems. But here, this group of people devoted to St. Anne prayed to her, and she saved an entire neighborhood of our city.
I never knew that story until I think it was 2 years ago. I was out in Scranton, and I saw, you know, in the distance, there was a big, beautiful church. I'm like, what is it? I need to find out what this is. So we drove and we found that it was St. Anne's Basilica. And St. Anne, like I said, in my family, she's very important. So I'm like, I had the goosebumps, goose pimples. I said, holy cannoli, this is God's providence to show me this amazing, beautiful basilica right in front of me. I was blown away. Because I went to visit St. Lucy's Church.
Right, I remember that's how you and I met.
Yes,
so Father Peretti hooked us up.
That church is
amazing. Yeah.
Oh, it's so much history there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So much history.
Oh yeah.
So we were talking a little bit, Stephen. How's your phone?
10%.
10%. Oh my gosh.
So before we lose Stephen, I am showing a picture of. So this is the actual before Ro came on. This week I was showing this picture of San Rocco. So this is the statue of San Rocco that is now in Most Precious Blood Church in New York City on Baxter Street. So Stephen, can you give us a little bit of the history of this statue? I know, again, it dates back to the beginning.
Absolutely. This is the original statue imported from Italy, made in Italy, and which arrived in Lower Manhattan in early August of 1889. On the bottom, it says, Confraternita di San Rocco de Potenza, fondato 1889 in Italian at the moment, but 1889, Potentini Lucani, meaning, you know, Basilicata people from Potenza di New York. So that's the plaque that's at the bottom. It's this Confraternity of St. Rocco of Potenza, founded August 16th, 1889. So it is the exact same statue. It has undergone literally no renovation. We had someone come in for the 125th to do stuff, and he basically said to us, there's nothing to do. We're going to wipe him down with some kind of an alcohol. So, I mean, I doubt it was alcohol, but some kind of a solution of that type, and he'll be ready. And he is spectacular and miraculous. We could talk for hours, and hopefully, Anthony, we'll have more St. Rocco talks with you. But this, he is truly a miraculous statue and an artistic wonder. In the 70s, the men that were in the study were quite old, and the then president / treasurer, Angelo Carnevale, was afraid they might break St. Rocco during a procession, hitting a bump because they could no longer carry him. They put him on a cart. So she commissioned from northern Italy a wooden statue of him, a duplicate of this statue, with a wooden arch that would be extremely heavy and would sit on a cart and not tilt if it hit a pothole. That was used every year except the 100th anniversary. This statue was used with that wooden arch to give it strength, and she was worried the entire time until I became president and involved a lot of young men. And I said, I'm not carrying dragging St. Rocco. We're going to carry him. So we began to carry the extremely heavy, quote unquote, processional statue. For our 125th, the members begged me to please carry the original because the other one is beautiful, but this one is the special one. And he asked if we could do it for 125. I said, sure. Everyone was so thrilled, and we're not the young 20-year-old guys we were, so it's time maybe for not something as heavy, and we decided to continue to use the original St. Rocco with great care, because he's the one. This is St. Rocco of Potenza in New York City. So as I said, he has miraculous, it hasn't been declared. We were the forgotten church in a forgotten place of forgotten people, but so no church has declared this statue miraculous, I think, just by pro popolo, just the people know that this is a miraculous statue of him. But any statue of him is miraculous because he's with us at all times. It's the faith that makes him present.
That's true. Actually, Eric, our friend Eric Lavin, he said that that Lucania comes from the ancient tribe of people there. That's where the name
That's where correct. And Mussolini, when wanting to make things, get back to Roman and Italic things, changed the name from Basilicata to Lucania because he wanted it to be. So that period of fascist rule, it was not Basilicata, it was Lucania. Wow. Then after the war, it went back to Basilicata, which has more of a Byzantine Greek origin than Lucania.
Well, many of the southern Italian, there is that strong Greek Byzantine influence in a lot of southern Italian towns.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Mussolini wanted,
he was the
Italians. Yeah, right. Yeah. So he didn't want to emphasize the hundreds of other cultures that are part of our culture and that influenced us.
Yeah, so you wanted to go back to the what was the origin or the origins of the area.
Anthony, forgive me. I'm afraid because I'm at now 7%. Okay. Do you want me to say anything else specifically?
Tell us about the name of the website and stuff like that. Social media, things like that.
All right. Well, we have a Facebook page, St. Rocco Society of Potenza in New York. www.strocco.com. Thank you, Anthony. So as I said, we have the Facebook, we have the website. And I am accessible to anyone who ever wants to talk about St. Rocco or needs a prayer card, because I've done everything I've been the president and involved in this for more than half my life. This is, one of the most important parts of my life is my devotion to St. Rocco. And I've done everything to bring it back to us. I was quoted, and I think it's a book by, I don't want to say the author's name because he might be insulted if I picked the wrong author. But I said, this is in our blood and it needs to be reinvented. Not reinvented, reawakened. A lot of people have forgotten. And what that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're the first generation or the fourth. Mm-hmm. Some families kept it, some didn't. Some, but we need it. And if ever that was more poignant, it's now. We need St. Rocco to save us from this horror. I won't even even say the name of it. You know, my son teases me. Come on, Dad, say it. I said, it's another Southern Italian thing. I don't want to name the bad thing out loud. But I call it this horror, and it is a horror. But I know with all my heart, St. Rocco is standing by all his children and protecting us. And we have to have faith. And whether his feast is in August or later on or next August, when we meet again for St. Rocco's feast, we intend to make it the biggest and best ever. We thought 125 was big. Well, we're going to make it bigger because he's not abandoned us, and we're not going to abandon him. That's for
definitely.
Sure.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much. Stephanie, if you have a couple of minutes, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about your area of Pennsylvania. But Stephen, I want to thank you so much for taking time out for coming on the show.
Thank you, my friend. It's always my honor. Stephanie, what a pleasure to meet you. You and I have lots to talk about in the future.
I can't wait. I sent you a friend request on Facebook already. So
you got it. You know, Anthony, you are bringing together, and I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about Stephanie and others, the biggest and brightest of our community. And I thank you because that's how we're going
to. We have to stick together. We need to stick together.
Absolutely. We've got to grow. We've got to grow. I look at my little Salvatore. You know, the little interrupter here. You know, I want him to have. He can't have the memories I have of my grandparents and great grandparents, but he can live through mine. The way I heard my grandmother talk about her grandmother, and the whole family said, "You are just like your great 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 grandmother, a woman who died, you know, in the 40s." But the stories kept her alive. So let's keep this a living faith and a living culture. So viva Southern Italy. Viva San Rocco.
Viva San Rocco.
Viva San Rocco.
Viva.
Ciao, ciao. San Rocco accompagna tutti quanti. Bye bye.
Ciao, Stephen. That's great. So, awesome. Stephanie, before I let you go, I'd like to just talk to you for a few minutes. Hold on one second. Here we go. Okay, so just talk to you a couple of minutes if you have some time. A little bit about, because I know that you're also an award-winning author. You've written obviously articles. You have a website, but you also wrote. How many books have you written?
3 books.
Okay, so kind of can you tell us? Are they all Italian or Italian? I shouldn't say not in Italian, but are they Italian themes? Yeah.
So they're all about the Italian-American history of Northeastern Pennsylvania. So my first one was Italians of Northeastern Pennsylvania. My second one was Dunmore. So focusing on that wonderful Italian community and non-Italian. I focused a little bit about both in that book. And then my most recent was Italians of Lackawanna County. And that's the one that got me that gold medal that I'm very proud of. So
correct me if I'm wrong. That is the book on the cover is the race. They call it
La Corsa dei Ceri.
La Corsa dei Ceri. Now this is something because you are from that area. Because that's in Jessup, right? The Feast of Santo Baldo, which now we're coming into it. This is his month. And unfortunately, it was canceled both in Italy in Gubbio, and it was canceled here in the States. So can you tell us, so obviously you know the history of it. So can you tell us a little bit about who Santo Baldo is and a little bit about this race that they have in the streets of both Gubbio, which is in the Provincia di Perugia, correct?
Yes.
And here or there in northeastern Pennsylvania in Jessup.
Yes. So the festivities in honor of Santo Baldo here in Lackawanna County, to me, and please forgive me, Guardiers out there, but these festivities in honor of Santo Baldo really are the standard bearer in Lackawanna County. They do such an amazing job up in Jessup for all of their work throughout the year to really preserve and maintain their traditions with Santo Baldo. In Gubbio, Santo Baldo at the time was actually the bishop of the town, and he went for negotiations with Frederick Barbarossa. And unfortunately, the townspeople didn't know what happened to Bishop Ubaldo at the time. So they took him and paraded him through the town. And that's actually how La Corsa dei Ceri came about, because these Ceri that you see, so there's 3 of them for Santo Baldo, which is in yellow. Then there's St. George in blue and St. Anthony in black. That comes from Santo Baldo being paraded through the streets of Gubbio, just so the townspeople knew that he was okay.
So what is the significance then of San Giorgio and Sant'Antonio?
So all the different saints represent something different in Jessup. So Santo Baldo represents the town's stonemasons. I always get a little bit mixed up. This town's stonemasons. St. Anthony is the laborers, and St. George is another one. I'm trying to say, there it is. I try to see the book. So I was so prepared on Guardia for tonight, though.
I threw a curveball at you.
You threw a major curveball, but that's okay. So St. Anthony is the peasants and laboring classes. St. George is the tradesmen and merchants, and Santo Baldo is the stonemasons. So I was right. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, you know your stuff. So
my street cred's good.
Here's a picture of, I guess this is in Jessup. And I guess
that's first, Church Street.
Yeah. First is Santo Baldo. Next one is San Giorgio.
One appears to be that is San Giorgio. You can see the little blue cape, and then San Antonio is in the back.
He's cut off.
Yeah, each one of those that you can see. So all of the saints are represented by what's called a family. So the family of Santo Baldo is represented in yellow, and they each, you know, St. George in blue, St. Anthony in black. There's a group of 10 that actually carries that chiaro throughout the town. And the person in charge of that is the capo dieci, so the head of 10. That's what it would be. And it's pretty cool. If you've ever seen the Alzata, I really would love to see you come out to Jessup at some point when this is going on so you can see it. After Mass, they have this beautiful thing called the Alzata, where they're actually getting the chiari together, and the capo dieci comes up on top of it, and he's handed this traditional brocca, which is a beautiful vase, pitcher vase that they have, and they throw it from the top. And it breaks. And that's just to symbolize good luck during this. Because if, God forbid, they drop the saint, or if the saint kind of veers off a little bit, that's considered bad luck. And it's considered a disgrazia. And it's never happened once, thank goodness. But, you know, they do these things. If you go to the St. Ubaldo Cultural Center in Jessup, the place is amazing because they have all these amazing artifacts for Santo Baldo there. You could really lose yourself. You'll see the beautiful fiberglass statue, and I have it in the book right here. Yeah. So this one right here that you see, the town of Gubbio actually donated that to Jessup a few years back in recognition of their special relationship. There's constantly contingents from Jessup going to Gubbio and people from Gubbio coming to Jessup. They handle their festival much like Dunmore does with Guardia. They never will have La Corsa dei Ceri before Gubbio. If Gubbio cancels it, Jessup is going to cancel. They're very traditional. They try to keep it as by the book as possible. The only thing different is the geography. They're in Pennsylvania. Gubbio's in Italy. But if you look, I think I even have a picture of the Alzata here in the book that I could show you. The woman who donated the photos to this, Linda Anelli, did some beautiful things. But you can actually see that's the Alzata there. And you can kind of see them getting their brocche.
Yeah.
This. But if you look in the back, I mean, that's the topography of Jessup, but it looks like it could be Italy. There's parts of northeastern Pennsylvania. I will tell you, as a Guardiais, having been to Guardia, there are parts of Bunker Hill where if I'm tired and don't have enough caffeine in my system, I think I'm in Guardia.
But then let me ask you, so a lot of people from Gubbio, I guess, then settle. I mean, that's, you know, you always think when you think of the Italian immigrants coming to America, you think of the Southern Italians, but you rarely think of Umbria.
Right.
So, it's true. What do you know any, like, why did they?
Yeah. The coal mines. Northeastern Pennsylvania with the coal mines really drew a lot of people. If you look through just the whole region's history, the town of West Pittston in Luzerne County. So that's another one that was in that top 20 most populous Italian American towns. Five towns between Lackawanna and Luzerne County are in that top 20, but we're not considered a heavily Italian area of the United States for some reason. That drives me crazy. That's like my little soapbox. My poor colleagues and friends at the Italian American podcast have to hear me talk about that all the time. It's, you know, Pennsylvania is important too.
It is.
And it's very important to me, especially, but I'm from here. I know I'm biased, but Gualdo Tadino and West Pittston have also a sister city relationship, and they're near Gubbio. They're relatively close. They have a museum with an entire exhibit on West Pittston. In fact, for Italians in northeastern Pennsylvania, most of my West Pittston photos came from Gualdo Tadino. The people in West Pittston that I contacted just said to me, talk to the museum in Gualdo. And that's how I got the photos for the book for that. So a lot of that came.
So that's also in Umbria.
Yes.
Because I mean, but the thing is, are there, but Are there coal mines in Umbria?
I'm not really.
That's the thing. That's the thing that I always wonder. Like, you know, okay, so you know, like they came here for the railroads. They came here for the coal mines. They came here for. They used to work up in Endicott. They worked in Endicott Johnson Shoe Factory. Yeah. You see, I always wonder: is did they come here because they had this basis or this or they had these what would you say these professions in Italy? That's the thing that always fascinates me, because a lot of times they came here as just contadini, as just, you know, farmers, as, you know, laborers, as poor people, but yet they came here and they were able to adapt to what was kind of literally thrown at them. So whether it was, you know, learning how to lay track for a railroad, how to dig a coal mine, really, I mean, for me, it just blows my mind that, you know, people when people talk disparagingly about Italians or Italian Americans, it's like, if it wasn't for the Italian people, this country would not be as strong or as powerful as it is today. I mean, you think of all the skyscrapers in New York City; they were built on the backs of the Italians. Obviously, there are other ethnicities that helped to build it, but when you think about it. It was the Italians that gave a lot of blood, sweat, tears in their lives to build our country.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, here in northeastern Pennsylvania, you can't go anywhere without seeing the Italian influence. My great-grandfather from Guardia, they had chestnut groves. And the reason why they had to leave Guardia is because there was a chestnut plague that killed off the crop.
Wow.
The phylloxera pest came into Guardia. It killed off the chestnut crop. And even to this day, there's not that many chestnut trees. I've gone by my family's former land. There's no chestnut trees there because they were killed off. So my great-grandfather had to adapt and had to find another career. And fortunately, he discovered that he was very good with stonework. So he was actually employed by the coal mines, but he was employed outside the mines to build the retaining walls.
Really?
And thankfully, he never went down into a coal mine. You know, a lot of those poor miners, God bless them, from all ethnicities, ended up with severe health problems like black lung. You hear a lot around here. We just had the commemoration of the Knox Mine disaster in January. There's constant talk about mining disasters in Lackawanna County and northeastern Pennsylvania because of what happened. Mm. You can't go to Westside, where St. Anne's is and St. Lucie's. There's the cemetery there, the Washburn Street Cemetery. It's famous because that's actually where Hillary Clinton's parents are buried. But if you go into a certain section, it's all from the people who were killed in the Avondale mine disaster.
Really?
They're all Welsh immigrants that came. And unfortunately, there was a disaster in the mine and it killed about 20 or so miners. And there's an entire section just for these people. And the people from Wales actually come over on a regular basis and perform Welsh hymns at the Hyde Park Washburn Street Cemetery.
Really?
For this. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. The thing with northeastern Pennsylvania is that you're really never just your ethnicity. You know, I'm an Italian from northeastern Pennsylvania. I'm an anthracite Italian, as they say. I'm always extremely proud to say that, but I can appreciate all of the different cultures here. You don't live in this area without absorbing at least something from another culture. I happen to love the Irish culture. You know, Scranton has the third largest St. Patrick's Day parade in the country.
Wow.
And a lot of my best friends are Irish, and I love celebrating them. And then a couple days later, they celebrate me for St. Joseph's Day. So it's a nice, happy thing. It's just really beautiful. But yeah, Wales and Scranton have a very tight relationship. Even Lithuania and Scranton, we're the seat of the Lithuanian National Catholic Church, and we're the Vatican, for lack of a better word, for the Polish National Catholic Church.
That I do know Scranton was because there are a couple of we call them PNC, Polish National Catholic.
Yes.
There's a couple of churches actually right here in Bergen County, I guess Bergen and Passaic County that have I forget the name of the church. Maybe St. Peter's Church, but it's a PNC church. It's Polish National Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
There really is so much history that unfortunately, you know, by talking about this and you know, kind of bringing this to the surface, we're able to preserve it. Unfortunately, I mean, if I didn't talk to you or if I didn't do a little bit of my own research, I wouldn't know half this stuff. It really is fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I can spend so much time just learning about northeastern Pennsylvania. And the funny thing is, I'm born and bred here, but I'm still constantly discovering things, even just in our Italian community. Right now, I'm doing some extra research on Sigaro Toscano Parodi cigars. I'm doing some research on them because they come from Scranton.
Yeah.
And I've been talking to the family and doing some research there. And also some research that, oddly enough, intersects with my Irpinia things. there's been a lot of artisans that came from Solofra, which, going back to St. Rocco, he actually has a church there. Solofra is known for their tanneries, and the people in Solofra pray to St. Rocco, so this way they're protected from getting the boils that develop by working with the stuff for the tannery. It's pretty wild, but there's a lot of, oddly enough, a lot of artisans come from Solofra, and some of those artisans settled in Scranton. In fact, one of those artisans was the sculptor of St. Lucie's. So Agostino Russo sculpted the facade of St. Lucie's that you saw, and he's from Solofra.
That church really is, it's
breathtaking.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
The history. Did Father Freddy tell you about the mafia and the time that it was bombed out and all that stuff?
Yeah, he told me. Well, he said, I thought that he said it was something to do. I don't know if it was the black, not the black hand.
The black hand. Yeah, there was.
Yeah. Oh, the anarchists.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The anarchist one. There's several things that happened there. I mean, St. Lucie's was a hotbed for a lot of different things. And I just love walking around that church and seeing, you know, ever since he told me the difference with the two red and the two shades of red in the stained glass windows, every time I go in there.
Oh, because the bomb?
The bomb. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, the other interesting thing about that church, which you never see Judas depicted in really any church, and up in, if you look up
the choir loft,
there's him with the 30 pieces.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, that was the first Italian church in Lackawanna County, so it's considered the mother Italian church. Up until that point, the only Italian church in our area was actually down in Hazleton with Most Precious Blood, but because the Italians were coming in, my grandmother was baptized at St. Lucie's, and she came from South Scranton. They didn't have an Italian church in South Scranton, so her family had to trek over to Westside.
Hazleton predates Scranton?
Yes. Yeah, Scranton's a baby in terms of a city. So Luzerne County predates Lackawanna County. Lackawanna was formed out of Luzerne in 1878.
Because actually, our mutual friend, Pat O'Boyle, he actually, a couple of years ago, he took me out to Hazleton for the Feast of San Mauro Abate, and that was a heck of an experience. Beautiful, the church there was beautiful. The statue there was beautiful. But again, it's very different to what I'm used to here in North Jersey and New York City. It's a different because even last year I went to a couple of feasts in Norristown.
Yeah,
and they had a big Sicilian population, and actually some Avellanese went there from Montella.
Yes. So they have Montella.
They have San Salvatore as their feast, and then Our Lady of Sciacca, the Madonna del Soccorso, and both of those feasts were beautiful feasts, and we had a great time. I mean, I met the priest there, and really, but again, it's just like even just like the geography is so much different than what we have here. There is a lot more hills, a lot more. I mean, by us, it's just everything is flat over there. It's like 90 degrees out here, and you're sweating. But I took my wife, my poor wife. She was like, oh, she goes, we gotta keep on walking. I'm like, yeah, let's go. We keep on going. But really, it's to make those connections, even just to meet these people, because really, the people that have the devotion that continue these traditions, it really is just so important. And again, what you're doing, even just writing about it and your contributions to the Italian American podcast, I mean, it's just so important. And for that, I thank you for what you're doing, even with the Italian Enclaves Historical Society. That's another big undertaking that really trying to preserve these, like I think we talked about it on the show with Ray a couple of weeks ago about, these lesser known Italian enclaves, and there are so many of them that unfortunately don't get the same pop as Little Italy in New York or Boston or Philadelphia. I mean, even right in my own backyard, I'm surrounded by Italians and Italian Americans. It's just something that we need to preserve, because if you don't, we can kiss it goodbye, as they say, which is unfortunate.
It's true. I'm so protective of Pennsylvania, and I will always be protective of Pennsylvania because of that. Even Guardia, I get very aggravated sometimes because I feel like Irpini in the United States don't get their just dues sometimes because you don't tend to think of us, especially the Guardiese community. Even here in northeastern Pennsylvania, we're kind of, I don't want to say that we're pushed off to the side, but it's like, okay, they're in Bunker Hill. The people from Gubbio are in Jessup. There's people from Filito in Old Forge, and everybody's just kind of off on their own. And that's how it is. And My thing is, especially with regards to the St. Ubaldo festivities that are unfortunately canceled, right now, more than ever, I don't want to say that I'm not Guardiers, because I will always be first and foremost Guardiers. I think you know that just from knowing me. Mm-hmm. That's my number one thing. But right now, more than ever, I have to say I'm not just a Guardiers. I'm an Italian from Northeastern Pennsylvania. And the fact that this was postponed this year, this was canceled, that's happening to me. That's my heritage as an Italian from Northeastern Pennsylvania. It's not a Guardiers or a Gubbio thing. It's an Italian of Northeastern Pennsylvania thing. And when one festival gets canceled, it affects all of us. Yeah. And my heart breaks for my friends in Jessup. They were the most supportive people ever when I was working on my books. And to know that their festival isn't happening this year, I plan, as soon as I get it, because I ordered one off of the website that I've been sharing on Facebook, I plan on flying that flag in honor of all three of their saints during that weekend, because that is something that we all need to do. We need to put aside where, you know, our campanilismo, so to speak, at this point, and just really embrace it as an overall Italian-American culture and say, hey, this happened to our paisani. We want to support them.
Yeah, because, I mean, you think about it, because, again, like you said, if it happens to one of, you know, like I said, one of our paisani, it happens to us. It's the ripple effect. It kind of affects everybody and everything around it. I do have a comment here from Frank Costa. He said, "Yo, Tony, Montgomery County, is that a big Italian area in Pennsylvania? I'm not too sure where Montgomery County is, but
Montgomery County is Pennsylvania's most populous county. It is outside of Philadelphia, so it's down in southeast Pennsylvania. Okay. And let's face it, Philadelphia is the big Italian capital of Pennsylvania. Not per the census, it's still northeastern Pennsylvania.
Really?
Well, like I said, with the top five, the top 20 Italian towns per capita through the 2015 American Community Survey. The five that were from Pennsylvania are all from Lackawanna and Luzerne County, but the big Italian enclaves in Pennsylvania are down by Philadelphia and out in Pittsburgh. So, you know, and I love Philadelphia. I love the Museum of Italian Immigration down there. Marco is a good friend of mine. Yes. And what they're doing is amazing, too. I feel like all of us just find each other. We have this honing device and we just...
And actually, he said, Frank says, my father's name is Giuseppe after his grandfather. He was born on San Giuseppe's feast day.
So much history.
Yes, definitely, mm-hmm. definitely a lot of history. And the other thing before we end today, there is another area of Pennsylvania kind of closer to Route 78 called Eastern Pennsylvania. Yes. And that was a big Sicilian population. That's where some of my people from Sicily, they settled in that area of the world. And I only recently found out about this side of my family just by doing genealogical research. So I don't know. Do you do any of the genealogy stuff? Do you do the ancestry.com or anything like that?
I do. It's my favorite pastime. It's my favorite little hobby. Right now, I'm trying to solve a family mystery. So it's a Guardiers family mystery. And through the Antenati website that's out there, I don't know if you've checked that out,
I could show. I could actually probably share my screen and show you all the Italian things I have open. I love that site.
It's the greatest. So my Aunt Jenny, and I know that I've spoken about her many times. That was my grandfather's sister. My grandparents' wedding photo. I always keep it on my desk, and she was the maid of honor. There's my grandparents. So this is beautiful. Almost 80 years old. So their 80th wedding anniversary is May 15th.
Wow.
My Aunt Jenny told me that my great-grandfather's father, so my great-great-grandfather, died in a coal mining accident in West Virginia. And I was like, what? I thought the first ones to come to the United States were Salvatore, my great-grandfather, and then obviously my great-grandmother and my grandfather and Aunt Jenny and everybody after. And she was like, no, this happened. So I thought to myself, I don't know how I'm ever going to find this out. Well, in the time period that he would have been alive, I couldn't find any mining disasters except for the Monongo one in West Virginia. I'm just like, that doesn't seem right. So the one day I was like, you know what? I don't feel like doing too much. It was a Saturday. It was just as I was between my last job and then coming over to the podcast. I was very much like, I want to do Italian things, but I don't know what I want to do. So I just started playing around on Antenati. And I found where my great-great-grandmother had to have my great-great-grandfather legally declared dead in Guardia. Wow. And it said that he died in New York. So now it's like, what happened? Because all the other people that were legally declared dead, they had something that came from the consulate in New York, or somebody died in France. It was all 1890 that this happened. So now I'm wondering, well, did he really die? Did he make my great great grandmother into a white widow? What's going on here? Like, so now that I'm trying to solve. So it's an interesting question.
But I tell you, whenever you solve one question, or whenever you get the answer to one question, there's 1,000 other ones that open up. It drives me nuts.
It's insane. So now I'm trying to reconstruct my great grandfather specifically. And I found out that my great grandfather, now my aunt only recalled that he had a brother. So I knew that he had a brother, Francesco, and they both came to the United States. And I just figured, well, since my great-great-grandfather died while they were young, that's probably why there were only two children. Well, now I'm finding all these other children, and I'm just like, what is this? Well, funny thing is, the firstborn was named Giuseppe Antonio. Well, my grandfather was Giuseppe Antonio, and I realized Italian naming conventions, the third son gets to be named after the eldest brother. And I'm like, now I know who my grandfather's named after.
Say that again. What is the
naming conventions? Okay. So
I know that, you know, usually the father's the father's father, and then the father's or the mother's. But maybe just go through that, because the brother thing I didn't know about. But just go through the whole list.
So from my understanding, it's the firstborn son is named after the father. So I have an uncle Gaetano. So for Gaetano, the great-great-grandfather that was lost.
Yes.
And then we had another one that was named Angelo, which I'm not entirely sure where that went, because Nicoletta's father's name was actually Antonio. That was the baby that was their birth baby upon arrival. So their 9-month baby after getting to the United States was my Uncle Tony. But my grandfather was the third-born son, and usually the third-born son is named after the father's oldest brother.
You know, that's very interesting. And I think you might have helped me here.
Awesome.
You might have helped me here, because that is true, because you do see that name, like the brother's name as some of the kids' names. So it's like, why? But is a great you answer my question.
Well, you know, it's crazy because you can actually figure out how people are related. I mean, I'm Stephanie Ann, my mother's Anne Marie, and my grandmother was Anna. So, you know, the Anne comes through the family. Yeah, it's just one of those deals.
Yeah. And that I guess that is a good thing about the father's father, because that always helps to know which branch of the tree you come from. But I think it gets a little more difficult when with the woman sometimes. I guess the woman's names could be, because there were a lot of Anns, there were a lot of Marias. And so it's like, oh man. So you're trying to figure out, okay, who exactly is which family is that Maria part of? Which is 5,000 Marias.
It's insane. And I thank God that in our family, you know, my great grandmother was Nicoletta, my great aunt was Giovannina. So like, we have all these different names that it's easier to follow. But then as soon as I see a Maria, I'm like, oh, Maria, here we go.
Yeah. But Stephanie, this has been great. I want to thank you so much for taking time out to come on the show. Talk about San Rocco, talk about Northeastern Pennsylvania, talk about Guardia, talk about Irpinia. And before we do end, I just want you to just give us a little bit more about, you know, where we can find you, social media, your websites, stuff like that.
Sure. So, of course, I want everybody to check out the Italian American podcast. It is definitely the best resource out there for Italian American heritage and culture. The 5 co-hosts, and you saw Rosella tonight, they all do an amazing job, and everybody has a different area of expertise. So I strongly suggest that you check out the Italian American podcast. It's my honor and privilege to be the associate producer of that, and I really hope that people listen. And then my side project, so you can check me out at irpiniastories.com or stephanielongo.net. And I'm on Facebook. I love it when people friend request me on Facebook. I will talk to you for hours, so be prepared, especially if it's about Italian things. And, you know, I just love working with people. I love seeing people. I love feeding off of this passion. And, you know, I just thank God every day that I was born Italian American. I thank God that my mother taught it to me from an early age. Mm. And I thank God that, you know, I have such a strong tie to both Guardia, and I didn't talk about my grandmother's family's from La Mezza Terme in Calabria. And I'm very proud of both of that.
That is the, because I also, we didn't talk about food, which I'm very disappointed in myself. But next time, maybe within the next couple of weeks or so, I want you to come back. We'll talk about that side of your family. And definitely, I want to talk about food as well with you, because I know, I mean, if you get into it, we'll be here all night. But just talk about Old Forge. I'm just going to say Old Forge. Yeah. I'm just going to say Old Forge. I'll leave it at that, because we could be here for another 3 hours talking about.
3 hours talking about Northeastern Pennsylvania's pizza culture. Check out my Facebook, because right before I came on tonight, my mother and I went to the Roosevelt Beer Garden. So that is such a Northeastern Pennsylvania thing to even say that I went to a beer garden.
Hold on, what is this? Explain it real quick.
Heaven. So the Roosevelt Beer Garden was founded by Italians in 1933 in honor of, they named it for President Franklin D. Roosevelt, because that was the year that he took office. And it is a beer garden in Dunmore. And beer gardens throughout Northeastern Pennsylvania are just a fancy way of saying a bar, but we like to say beer garden. And they make the best pizza I have ever had.
Really?
Yes. And my mother and I tried their old-fashioned for the first time tonight, and we were just sitting there in ecstasy at the table. We were like, what is this, and how come we've never had this? She grew up in Dunmore. She never had it.
Well, I guess it's open for takeout.
It is open for takeout. It's fantastic, and it's just, there's like a beer in the crust. I don't understand how they did it. Like, to get the crust to puff up, they put
yes, okay.
Oh man, we ate so much of that pizza, and then I had ice cream before I came on.
I actually, before we came on, I was making some arborio rice pudding. So I'm gonna go downstairs and I'm gonna have a little dessert myself. But again, Stephanie, I want to thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun, and really it turned into two shows. We talked about San Rocco, but we also talked a little bit about, but again, we only barely scratched the surface about Northeastern Pennsylvania. So I would love to, if you're willing, I would love to have you back on to talk more about that, within the next week or so. We'll talk about that off the air. But again, Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for all that you do. You do an amazing job, and I hope that people watch you and just really enjoy.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Again, I want to thank my guests. I want to thank Stephanie Longo. I want to thank Rosella Rago. I want to thank Stephen LaRocca for taking time out to come on the At the Table with Tony live stream show. We'll see you next time. Ciao for now.
Right, ciao.
At the Table with Tony would like to thank its sponsors. Rocco Muriale, Rob Quick, Joseph Cirillo, Raymond Guarini, Tom Gilmore, Oli G, Peter Ziza, Brian McGuire, Peter Ferreira, Rich Ottenstrauer, Anna Mavrianos, Antonio Pepinella, Anthony Ferraro, Sandra and Bob Lamotta, Mike Guero, The Italian Enclaves Historical Society,